So good evening, everyone, and thank you for coming out on a nice evening. Tonight we're doing the first of a series, trying to vaguely answer the question of what is Zen, and I'm sure we won't succeed, but Kate and I thought we'd like to at least talk a little bit about some key areas. Just to help clarify our understanding of what we're doing here. And also just to prepare us a little bit for the practice period that's coming up very soon. Well, we're going to be looking at koan. And I'd like to emphasize that this kind of overview of Zen is going to be pretty brief. There's 1,500 years of history alone to cover, and then all those other topics that arose, and three different cultures, at least, in Asia. So it is going to be pretty brief. But along the way, we'll try to emphasize, you know, key areas and topics that have come down and are present in our own community, the Mountain Rain Zen community. And tonight, I'm going to bravely jump in and talk about Zen history. Over the next 3 weeks, we'll be also looking at practices, kind of the fundamental practices within Zen. We'll be looking at the Zen Dharma or teachings, key teachings, recent innovations or adaptations. I think that's about it, right? Those four areas which I cover. So I think this will be kind of fun, actually. I'm looking forward to it, and we'll make room for questions, particularly at the end. Perhaps more than rather than doing our little group discussions, we'll have a Q&A question or session at the end. So history. When I sat down and started thinking about this, my first problem was where to begin. Because in a sense, there are at least two different beginnings. There's the historical Shakyamuni Buddha. We could go all the way back to then. But then there's also the mytho-poetic creation of Zen literature, which came mostly out of the religious imagination of the Chinese people, which is just as relevant, if not more, than the historical facts that we know about the development of the Buddhist tradition. And I'll kind of explain that hopefully a little bit more as we go along. But perhaps we should start with just a few words about the Mahayana stream of Buddhism, just to kind of set the scene for us, this Mahayana and Theravadan difference. So Buddhism began about the year 500 BCE, before the Common Era, roughly. Buddha's birth and life is in much debate amongst scholars still. But the Mahayana stream, this kind of little bit revitalization, perhaps we could say, of the Buddha's teaching, started, you know, around the first century in the Common Era, maybe a little bit before, a little bit after. And it was kind of a reaction to, at least from the Mahayana view, of a kind of conservative philosophy and practices that had Buddhism had kind of dipped down into. At least this is from the Mahayana view, right? And those practices, they felt, overemphasized analysis, and they overemphasized reason, and they overemphasized the role of the monastic. So Mahayana was a movement towards a more kind of embracing style of practice that sought to engage the emotions, sought to engage the lay practitioners much more, without throwing out the rest, but just wanting to go back to what they felt were the roots that the Buddha had taught. So we can't go into the differences between the Mahayana stream and the earlier stream, which today we call the Theravadan stream. But I just wanted to mention that this was not really a formal school or sect of Buddhism, but rather a kind of set of ideals or ideas and practices that really focused on this image of what we call the bodhisattva, that this rose and this became really prominent, this idea of a bodhisattva, meaning a person who is awakening, an awakening being. And it refers to someone, including you or me or anybody, who has, at least to some extent, vowed to achieve awakening for the sake of all beings. In some texts, it's written to postpone your own ultimate awakening until everyone else in the whole cosmos is awakened. So I think we could say, from the Mahayana Buddhist point of view, all practicing Buddhists are really kind of apprentice bodhisattvas. We're all on this path to help everyone awaken as long together with us. And this stress on this bodhisattva path really inspired the creation of many different practices, many different philosophical approaches and texts and views to help aid in the different practices, and all kinds of other writings as well. Just to give you an idea of the scope that developed, the standard modern edition of the, we could say, the Chinese Buddhist Mahayana canon, that collection of texts that they hold as most important, consists, I'm looking at this one, this edition called the Taisho Tripitaka, it has 85 volumes in it. Most of which, I would say, have not been translated into English yet, but 85 volumes of stuff to help us on this bodhisattva path that we walk. So you can imagine, you know, different views, different practices that arose to help. Now, the other reason I wanted to just mention this is sometimes we think, I want to get the true Zen. I want the real thing. And I wanted to say that, you know, when we look at history, if we really look closely, there is no real thing. History shifts and changes the more that we look at it. There is no definite Zen tradition, definitive Zen tradition, but really, I think, a variety of ways that arose over a long period of time in different cultures to help us approach the Dharma. And each of these ways arose because of the different culture that they developed in, the different circumstances that were there, and maybe even the personalities of these characters that, you know, wrote and studied and all that. But they're all there to help us. They're all kind of skillful means that we can appreciate, I think, in our own practice. So out of that view, that Mahayana view, you know, all these ways of approaching practice, let's talk about Zen. And when we talk about Zen, we need to talk about China. In Chinese, Zen is referred to as Chan Buddhism. And it's quite interesting because Buddhism first entered China largely through trade. They had, you know, the Silk Road, we've all heard of that, or the Silk Route. Goods were moved back and forth between China and Central Asia and then made all the way into Rome, Greece, the Middle East, and eventually even Europe along the Silk Route. So Buddhism kind of made its way into China around the middle of the first century in the Common Era. Again, there's a lot kind of debate about that, how you would, where you draw the line. And gradually, there was more and more demand for translations of Buddhist texts into Chinese as people were trying to figure out what Buddhism was. And most of the texts were written either in Sanskrit or they're written in other Central Asian languages, many of which no longer exist. So this led to the arrival of translators, people who could speak or read in both languages. But the early translators had a real problem because they realized that Chinese lacked many of the philosophical terms and even ideas that were existent in Indian Buddhism at that time. So they did what all translators would do. They reached for the next best thing, which was Taoism, some of the language and terms in Taoism. And as a result, people began to equate, at least at the beginning, Buddhist ideas and practices with Taoist tradition that was already existing in China at that time. And that led to some confusion, but gradually the Chinese began to, or came to a point where they could really fully understand the teachings of the Buddha as they were expressed in Indian Buddhism. Maybe I shouldn't say fully, but you know, they had a pretty good grasp, I think. But there was another problem. Buddhism had already existed in India for a long time. Lots of ideas, lots of different approaches, different texts had written. But all of this was just suddenly arriving in China almost kind of helter-skelter. And they were trying to make sense of it because some of these texts seemed to almost contradict each other. Was there one Buddha? Were there a number of Buddhas? Was this text seems to say this is the best way, this text says that's the best way. And the Chinese found this very upsetting. Because in China, I think almost from the very beginning of Chinese civilization, the Chinese greatly valued lineage and careful order. If we look back at the early beginnings of Chinese civilization, one of the things they greatly venerated were the ancestors, the order, right? And so I could talk on for a while about different the dynasties and how that worked. But just to say who you were, who your ancestors were, was very important. And it was very important that you offered proper respect to your ancestors. Very important. And if you didn't, your life would fall into chaos. Disease, sudden death, misfortune, often they believe was caused because you did not properly honor the correct ancestor at the right time, in the right way. So that was very key within the Chinese idea of what this life was about. So when they got all these texts this way, they really, okay, wait a minute. We got to make some sense of this. It's got to be placed in the right order. And so they set about creating order out of all the various texts and practices that were entering China at that time. Now, they had no idea, really, of the correct chronology of what text was written first and then what text was written next. But they did their best, of course, developing an order that made the most sense to them. And they said, well, obviously, the Buddha gave certain teachings to prepare his disciples for the true teachings or the higher teachings that would occur later. And so they created a nice hierarchy of certain texts at the very top, one of them being the Lotus Sutra. Other people had different ideas, of course, but at any rate, they arranged them of what they thought was the correct order. And this emphasis on lineage is kind of important for us to keep in mind because it plays a very important role in Zen, how Zen developed in China. So, am I going too fast? It's already close to 1,000 years of history. So I want to talk now, I'm going to use a little bit of a technical term. One's called Proto-Chan. proto-Zen. So this is kind of what happened before we could really call Zen Zen at this point. And this is the time of the great Bodhidharma. Heard that word? Bodhidharma, a little bit? Familiar? So, according to the mythopoetic legends of Zen, again, you got to get this lineage down, right? Bodhidharma was a monk who came either from India or Central Asia, came into China, and brought the Zen teachings there, particularly one particular sutra. And famously said, I'm giving you the true teachings that are the transmission outside the scriptures, outside the literature, which did not stand upon words, but really focused on meditation. Now, whether Bodhidharma really existed or not, again, scholars like to argue about this, or maybe he was two people, that's another theory I've heard. But we do know at this time what really came into a strong acceptance in some Chinese monasteries was this idea of Buddha nature, or our true nature, became quite strong, a strong idea. That is that everybody possesses Buddha nature. We have this true nature within us, no matter whether you're enlightened or you're just an ordinary Joe or Jane. You all have this Buddha nature, but it's covered up in some way, kind of imperceptible because of our false sense impressions, our false ideas about what is reality and what isn't reality. It's kind of blanketed over. But we all have this great potential for awakening. So that's kind of beginnings of kind of the concepts that began to form this practice that we call Zen today. Now, I just wanted to add, there's lots of legends about Bodhidharma that are pretty cool. And one of the ones that I find really interesting was supposedly he sat facing a wall for 7 years after he arrived in China to kind of like show the Chinese this is how you do it. But he was, you know, falling asleep. And he was so frustrated, he cut off his eyelids and threw them out of the cave where he was sitting, and they landed on the ground. And guess what they turned into?
Camellia sinensis.
Exactly.
Tea.
Tea plants. They turned into tea plants to help us keep awake when we are meditating those long hours. But the truth is, one turned into a tea plant. The other one turned into a coffee plant. And another, you know, part of the story is he sat so long, you know, his kind of legs kind of almost fell off. And so you can see those Dharma dolls, which are kind of weighted on the bottom, and you tip them, they kind of keep coming up like that. There's lots of kind of fun, interesting stories about Bodhidharma. But he is considered the first ancestor of the Zen tradition who first brought this tradition from India. As time went on, they began to then create the rest of the lineage, or began to form. Bodhidharma apparently appointed a disciple, Huayka, to succeed him. And again, the legend about him, he was so frustrated and wanted to study, and Bodhidharma said, get out of here, I'm not interested in you, you know. I only want the serious practitioners. And so he displayed his seriousness by cutting off his arm and showing it to Bodhidharma. And then Bodhidharma said, okay, I guess you're serious enough. Well, I won't go into that, but there is a little bit of a history there in China about that. And Bodhidharma gave three symbols of this transmission to Huayka, this next disciple. That was a robe, a bowl, and I believe a copy of the Lankavatara Sutra as a symbol of, you've got it, kid. But then, as time went on, just leaving the legends aside for this, it's the next period that's called in scholarly literature early Chan. This is about 600 to 900 in the Common Era. This is the time of Huining, the sixth ancestor, who is also really key in the lineage. And this is when a lot of the lineage becomes quite solidified. Like then now they trace it all the way back to Buddha, right? Buddha gave it to this guy, gave it all the way up to Bodhidharma, and then now into the Chinese. So these are the patriarchs of the lineage. And this continues on all the way up to the present day. So if you go to Japan or China in an official temple, or even San Francisco where there's really established temple, they chant the lineage daily. And recently there's also created a woman's lineage as well. But during this period of time, there were large centers of meditation established. Certain teachers became very famous, kind of focused on meditation. This direct transmission from teacher to student became quite important, which wasn't that important in India at that time. And the reasons it was important was to show that this practice is really superior to many other kinds of practices, because we can actually go all the way back, just like we can go back in our ancestors. One mark for Zen. Second one is that the actual historical facts are not that important. But by having the lineage, you can really get an idea of the lore of the stories. And those stories are really important, as we'll see in just a moment here. I'm going to go back to this idea of stories. And the third thing was this was a kind of proof that the awakening experiences of the patriarchs or the key teachers are the complete, and there's no difference between that awakening and the awakening of the Buddha. It's all the same. Okay, so far so good? Okay. So now moving on to the next era, about 750 to 1000 in the Common Era. This is roughly the time of the Tang Dynasty. Wonderful time in Chinese history. This is when we begin to emerge what's often referred to as encounter dialogues as a part of the practice. And this is where monks would go up to a teacher and say, "Tell me the meaning of Zen." And the teacher would say, 3 pounds of flax. Or something equally philosophical like that. Or does a dog have Buddha nature? Moo. No. Yes. These, sounds like it's probably a very vibrant time in the Zen tradition. And these were later collected and became what we call today the collections of koans, or these dialogues between often between students and teachers. But that didn't happen really until a little bit later that they were actually collected. So now we're 900 to about 1300, the Song Dynasty, next kind of main period in Chinese history. The various collections started to appear, and we're going to be looking at one of those collections in the practice period, known as the Mumonkan in Japanese, the Gateless Gate. But during this period of time, two main approaches to Zen became established and very strong and still exist today. One was in Chinese called Linji, or in Japanese called Rinzai. That was the practice that really focused on using these koan, these questions, to help deeply penetrate and open the eye of understanding. Focus your practice on this question, over and over again until there is some kind of experience of insight or awakening. And the other approach that was also very strong at this time, Chinese called Caodong and in Japanese called Soto, and this was an emphasis on, kind of shikantaza, or that kind of, sometimes referred to as silent illumination, you know, following the breath and just entering into a deep sense of presence, very, very profound sense of this present moment. And again, lots of lore and literature. There were two Chinese masters at this time, Dahui and Hongzhi. Dahui was the Koan school. Hongzhi was the silent illumination school. And apparently there was lots of kind of dialogue, like silent illumination is so wishy-washy. No focus, no energy. Or the Koan school is so, you know, me focused. But actually they were good friends and supported each other in these practices. But both these schools continue on today. There were other schools of Zen that disappeared, or at least followed in the Zen school. And today, there's the Rinzai both, and the Soto, particularly strong in Japan, and also come over to the West. How am I doing for time? Good. A couple more minutes and I'll wind up. So, both these streams got transferred to Japan. A guy named Eisai brought the Rinzai school, and of course, our familiar Dogen Zenji brought the Soto school to Japan, and both became established. But there's a difference that I think is kind of important for us to know about. The Rinzai school, this kind of Koan school, became really popular amongst the kind of ruling class of Japan, which were the samurai, the kind of a warrior class. And the Soto school became quite popular amongst farmers, merchants, kind of the people who were not the ruling class. But there was lots of dialogue and communication between them. Both schools, you know, practice with koans, sometimes a little different way, sometimes the same way. And there's lots more kind of Japanese history that we could talk about there. But we're not going to. Instead, I just want to mention something about Japanese history that is important for us to know about. Buddhism was quite suppressed when Japan started to modernize. So we're talking about 1868 to about, 1926 or so. The government, the emperor was no longer, the shogun was no longer in power. There was a kind of small group of men, an oligarchy, that was ruling Japan at this point. It was kind of a paper democracy in a way. And they suppressed Buddhism and instituted changes to take away the power from Buddhism. And one of those changes was, they said, monks who up to this point had supposedly been celibate should and can marry, because that would take away the power from the Buddhist institutions. They also took away a lot of the economic support that the Buddhist institutions had. And so today, the Soto school has about 31 training monasteries. The Rinzai has about 7 main training monasteries, so the Soto is quite a bit larger. But because the priests could marry and they had families, meant they had to be worried about the economic situation, support their families. And this caused some radical changes in how Buddhism is, particularly Zen, is, well, all Buddhism is practiced in Japan. Buddhist monks, priests, I guess, really, people looking after small parishes now had to support their families. And often, as what's happened in the West as well, there was a large exodus from the countryside into the cities, particularly those monasteries, those temples in the countryside. The monks couldn't support themselves, their families. They opened schools, they did things to try to support themselves, but they made most of their money by conducting funerals, which are pretty expensive in Japan. In fact, the Japanese priests, one term that they were often called was bozu marumoke, which means a kind of monk who works with very little or low overhead but gets paid well. Sometimes the Japanese also call it funeral Buddhism. So Buddhism is undergoing radical changes in Japan to try modernize. I've heard of Zen monks now who have opened bars, coffee shops, and they practice the Dharma in the bar, just like, you know, the old-fashioned bartender who would be, you know, what's your problem? Yeah, all kinds of new ways to try support the Dharma. Well, I was going to also talk a little bit about Buddhism coming to the West, but maybe I should pause here or stop here and open the floor for questions so we have some time for a Q&A.
Should we make a circle?